was intended as a workaround for CA's bad behavior, or you could interpret it as a promise of future functionality. If you interpreted it as the former, then you were required to recognize all the revenue up front. If you interpreted it as the latter, then you would recognize the revenue ratably over the course of the contract. In either case, cash payments would be the same. We understood this ambiguity when we signed the three deals that contained the clause. So we had our E&Y partner, Dave Price, audit the deals and then tell us how we should account for them. Dave correctly understood the intent and recommended that we take the revenue up front in all three deals. BMC's E&Y partner concluded the opposite, and they accounted for similar deals ratably. When alerted to the difference, the BMC partner escalated the issue to Ernst & Young's national office. E&Y's national audit partner called me to report that he now disagreed with his partner's audit and required that we restate revenue guidance in the next 48 hours. I couldn't believe what I had just heard. Restating revenue would tank the stock price and destroy the pending sale. The accounting had no material impact on cash flows, and our treatment was based on the judgment of Ernst & Young in the first place. If they had accounted for it the other way initially, the stock price would be the same as it is now. It was the restatement that would kill us. What the hell? I calmed down and replied carefully. Ben, the accounting is meant to reflect the intent of both us and our customers in the contract, correct? E&Y. Correct. Ben, so why don't we call all three customers on the phone and ask them their intent? If it's what Dave Price reflected in our contracts, then we'll leave them as they are. If it's something else, we'll restate revenue. E&Y. No, that's not good enough. You'll need to get all three customers to amend their contracts to use new language that we've come up with at E&Y to clear things up. Ben. But all three customers are large banks. They have risk departments. They won't just amend their contracts quickly. To make things worse, we are in the middle of a $1.6 billion transaction. You will wreck our deal. E&Y. We don't care. That's what you have to do. Ben. But we've been a customer for 8 years, paid you millions of dollars in fees, and your partner made this judgment to begin with. Why would you destroy our transaction if we and the customers verbally agree with the current interpretation? E&Y. Either amend the contracts or restate your revenue. You have 48 hours. Dave Price looked like he was going to burst into tears. E&Y's national office did not care about the spirit of the law, only the letter. They refused to do what was right from an accounting or business standpoint. They were determined to do what was optimally convenient for Ernst & Young. My CFO, Dave Conte, was pale as a ghost. Hundreds of people had worked 8 years to get to this point, and it looked like all that work would be flushed down the toilet by the accounting firm that Dave handpicked. He had worked at Ernst & Young for 15 years before joining Opsware. Normally gregarious and outgoing, he could barely speak. I was furious at everybody, but I knew that nothing that I could say would help the problem or make Dave feel any worse than he already felt. I turned to Jordan Breslow, my general counsel, and said, "Do we have to disclose this to the acquirers right away?" Horrifyingly, he said, "Yes." We told HP and BMC about the discrepancy and that we thought we could resolve the issue by amending the contracts in the next 24 hours. Neither party believed us. I don't know if I believed it. How could we possibly get three large banks to amend their contracts in 24 hours? Both potential buyers made plans to respond to the news and update their position and possibly their bids. In the meantime, Dave, Mark Cranny, and I went to work to get the contracts amended. We sat in the finance conference room, drawing lines between everybody we knew in the world and tried to figure out how to get the right people in time to save the deal. I called every board member to see which bank he kept his money in and whether he had any influence or knew somebody with influence. Mark stayed on the phone with the sales reps and the people whom we knew at the accounts. Jordan and Dave came up with 10 different ways to word the amendment. We stayed up all night working on the deal, and the entire time, Dave looked as though he was having a massive heart attack. Miraculously, by 11 a.m., we got all three contracts amended, and it was in less than 24 hours. We would not have to restate revenue. Not surprisingly, the entire thing spooked BMC, and they withdrew their bid. They did not believe that the issue had been put to bed. HP wasn't spooked, but they lowered their offer to $13.75 per share due to the taint on the deal. That night, the board met in our offices to discuss the new offer from HP and informed them that BMC had dropped out. The board was unanimous in its advice that we should take the $13.75 offer. I disagreed. I said that I would not take a nickel less than the $14.25 originally offered. Bill Campbell looked at me like I was a general who had spent too much time in the field. At that point, I had not slept and didn't know if he was right or wrong. I just knew that I had waited all night to be right, and I couldn't get much wronger. I gathered myself and restated my position. HP offered $14.25, a price that equals 16 times trailing 12 months' revenue for one reason and one reason only. They offered it because we are the premium company, the gold standard, if you will, in an important market. That is the entire premise of this deal. The second that we accept a discounted offer or in any other way suggest that we are not the gold standard, this deal falls apart. John O'Farrell nodded in agreement. The board uneasily accepted my position. I went back to HP and told them the deal would be $14.25 or nothing. After about a two-hour pause, during which time the color never returned to Dave Conte's face, they accepted. We had a deal. A deal for about $100 million less than if our so-called partner had not stabbed us in the back, but a deal nonetheless. I still hate Ernst & Young. I'm telling this story today because just when you think there are things you can count on in business, you quickly find that the sky is purple. When this happens, it usually does no good to keep arguing that the sky is blue. You just have to get on and deal with the fact that it's going to look like Barney for a while. Solving the accountability versus creativity paradox. A software engineer identifies a weakness in your current product architecture that will significantly impair its ability to scale down the road. She figures out that she'll have to slip the product schedule 3 months to fix it. Everybody agrees that 3 months is an acceptable slip to correct the problem. The schedule actually slips 9 months, but she was right about the problem. Do you reward her for her creativity and courage, or hold her accountable for the slip? If you become a prosecuting attorney and hold her to the letter of the law on her commitments, you will almost certainly discourage her and everybody else from taking important risks in the future. If you take this stance consistently, don't be surprised in the future if your people don't have time to solve hard problems because they will be far too busy covering their butts. On the other hand, if you don't hold her accountable for a commitment, then people who actually do the work to meet their commitments might feel like idiots. Why did I stay up all night making the deadline if the CEO rewards the person who missed her schedule by 6 months? If your hardest working, most productive employees feel like chumps, and you are looking for the culprit, look in the mirror. You have failed to hold people accountable for their actions. Welcome to the accountability versus creativity paradox. As we look to solve it, let's start with the most basic assumption. Do you assume that your employees are by and large creative, intelligent, and motivated? Or do you assume that they are lazy, conniving, and counting the minutes to quitting time? If you believe the latter, then you might as well just give up on creativity and innovation in your organization, because you will not get it. It's better to believe the former and assume that people have good intentions unless they prove otherwise. Still, you must hold people accountable to avoid the chump factor. How do you think about that? Let's look at accountability across the following dimensions: promises, results, and effort. Accountability for effort. This is the easy one. To be a world-class company, you need world-class effort. If somebody isn't giving it to you, they must be checked. Accountability for promises. A lot of good running organizations have statements like, make a commitment, keep a commitment. It's true that if you sign up for something and you don't do it, you let everyone in the organization down. This type of letdown can be contagious. Holding people accountable for their promises is a critical factor in getting things done. This changes as the degree of difficulty in fulfilling the promise increases. Promising to complete a piece of marketing collateral or send an email is different from promising to meet an engineering schedule that involves solving some fundamentally hard computer science problem. You must hold people accountable for the former. The latter is more complicated and relates to results. Accountability for results. This is where things get complicated. If someone fails to deliver the results you promised, as in the opening story, must you hold her accountable? Should you hold her accountable? The answer is that it depends. It depends upon seniority of the employee. You should expect experienced people to be able to forecast their results more accurately than junior people. Degree of difficulty. Some things are just plain hard. Making your sales number when your product is inferior to the competition and a recession hits mid-quarter is hard. Building a platform that automatically and efficiently takes serial programs and parallelizes them so that they can scale out is hard. It's hard to make a good prediction and hard to meet that prediction. When deciding the consequence of missing a result, you must take into account the degree of difficulty. Amount of stupid risk. While you don't want to punish people for taking good risks, not all risks are good. While there is no reward without risk, there is certainly risk with little or no chance of corresponding reward. Drinking a bottle of Jack Daniels, then getting behind the wheel of a car, is plenty risky. But there's not much reward if you succeed. If someone missed a result, did she take obviously stupid risks that she just neglected to consider? Or were they excellent risks that just did not pan out? Revisiting the opening problem. So looking back at the opening problem, here's some things to consider. 1. How senior is she? If she's your chief architect, you'll need her to get better at scoping her work, or she's going to trash the organization. If she's more junior, this should be more a teaching moment than a scolding moment. 2. How hard was it? If it was a miracle that you ever made that piece of crap scale, then you shouldn't yell at her. In fact, you should thank her. If it was a relatively trivial project that just took too long, then you need to address that. 3. Was the original risk the right one to take? Would the product really have run out of scale in the short to medium term? If the answer is yes, then whether it took 3 months or 9 months, it was the right risk to take, and if faced with the same situation again, you probably should not change any of your actions. You shouldn't be wringing your hands about that. Final point. In the technology business, you rarely know everything up front. The difference between being mediocre and magical is often the difference between letting people take creative risk and holding them too tightly accountable. Accountability is important, but it's not the only thing that's important. The Freaky Friday Management Technique. Many years ago, I encountered a particularly tricky management situation. Two excellent teams in the company, customer support and sales engineering, went to war with each other. The sales engineers escalated a series of blistering complaints, arguing that the customer support team did not respond with urgency, refused to fix issues in the product, and generally inhibited sales and customer satisfaction. Meanwhile, the customer support group claimed that the sales engineers submitted bugs without qualification, did not listen to valid suggested fixes, and were alarmists who assigned every issue the top priority. Beyond the actual complaints, the teams genuinely did not like each other. To make matters worse, these groups had to work together constantly in order for the company to function. Both teams boasted superb personnel and outstanding managers, so there was nobody to fire or demote. I could not figure out what to do. Around this time, I miraculously happened to watch the motion picture classic Freaky Friday, starring the underrated Barbara Harris and the incomparable Jodie Foster. There's also a high-quality remake starring Jamie Lee Curtis and the troubled but talented Lindsay Lohan. In the film, mother and daughter grow completely frustrated with each other's lack of understanding and wish that they could switch places, and through the magic of film, they do. Through the course of the movie, by being inside each other's bodies, both characters develop an understanding of the challenges that the other faces. As a result, the two become great friends when they switch back. After watching both the original and the remake, I knew that I'd found the answer. I would employ a Freaky Friday management technique. The very next day, I informed the head of sales engineering and the head of customer support that they would be switching jobs. I explained that, like Jodie Foster and Barbara Harris, they would keep their minds but get new bodies. Permanently. Their initial reactions were not unlike the remake, where Lindsay Lohan and Jamie Lee Curtis both scream in horror. However, after just 1 week walking in the other's moccasins, both executives quickly diagnosed the core issues causing the conflict. They then swiftly acted to implement a simple set of processes that cleared up the combat and got the teams working harmoniously. From that day to the day we sold the company, the sales engineering and customer support organizations worked better together than any other major groups in the company. All thanks to Freaky Friday, perhaps the most insightful management training film ever made. Staying great. As CEO, you know that you cannot build a world-class company unless you maintain a world-class team. But how do you know if an executive is world-class? Beyond that, if she was world-class when you hired her, will she stay world-class? If she doesn't, will she become world-class again? These are complex questions and are made more complex by the courting process. Every CEO sets out to hire the very best person in the world and then recruits aggressively to get him. If he says yes, she inevitably thinks she's hit the jackpot. If I had a tattoo for every time I heard a CEO claim that she just hired the best VP in the industry, I'd be Lil Wayne. So we begin with a strong bias that whoever we hired must be world-class even before performing 1 day of work. To make matters worse, executives who start off world-class often deteriorate over time. If you are a sports fan, you know that world-class athletes don't stay world-class for long. One day you are Terrell Owens, and the next day, you are Terrell Owens. While executives don't age nearly as fast as athletes do, companies, markets, and technologies change 1,000 times faster than the game of football. As a result, the executive who was spectacular in this year's 100-person startup may be washed up in next year's version when the company employs 400 people and has $100 million in revenue. The standard. The first thing to understand is that just because somebody interviewed well and reference checked great, that does not mean she will perform superbly in your company. There are two kinds of cultures in this world. Cultures where what you do matters, and cultures where all that matters is who you are. You can be the former, or you can suck. You must hold your people to a high standard. But what is that standard? I discussed this in the section Old People. In addition, keep the following in mind. You did not know everything when you hired her. While it feels awkward, it is perfectly reasonable to change and raise your standards as you learn more about what's needed and what's competitive in your industry. You must get leverage. Early on, it's natural to spend a great deal of time integrating and orienting an executive. However, if you find yourself as busy as you were with that function before you hired or promoted the executive, then she's below standard. As CEO, you can do very little employee development. One of the most depressing lessons of my career, when I became CEO, was that I could not develop the people who reported to me. The demands of the job made it such that the people who reported to me had to be 99% ready to perform. Unlike when I ran a function or was a general manager, there was no time to develop raw talent. That can and must be done elsewhere in the company, but not at the executive level. If someone needs a lot of training, she is below standard. It is possible to take the standard setting too far, as I discussed in the section, The Scale Anticipation Fallacy, it's neither necessary nor a good idea to evaluate an executive based on what her job will be 2 years from now. You can cross that bridge when you come to it. Evaluate her on how she performs right here and right now. On expectations and loyalty. If you have a great and loyal executive, how do you communicate all this? How do you tell her that despite the massive effort and great job she's doing today, you might fire her next year if she doesn't keep up with the changes in the business? When I used to review executives, I would tell them, you are doing a great job at your current job, but the plan says that we will have twice as many employees next year as we have right now. Therefore, you will have a new and very different job, and I will have to reevaluate you on the basis of that job. If it makes you feel better, that rule goes for everyone on the team, including me. In providing this kind of direction, it's important to point out to the executive that when the company doubles in size, she has a new job. This means that doing things that made her successful in her old job will not necessarily translate to success in the new job. In fact, the number one way that executives fail is by continuing to do their old job rather than moving on to their new job. But what about being loyal to the team that got you here? If your current executive team helped you grow your company tenfold, how can you dismiss them when they fall behind in running the behemoth they created? The answer is that your loyalty must go to your employees, the people who report to your executives, your engineers, marketing people, salespeople, and finance and HR people who are doing the work. You owe them a world-class management team. That's the priority. Should you sell your company? One of the most difficult decisions that a CEO ever makes is whether to sell her company. Logically, determining whether selling a company will be better in the long term than continuing to run it standalone involves a huge number of factors, most of which are speculative or unknown. And if you are the founder, the logical part is the easy part. The task would be far simpler if there were no emotion involved. But selling your company is always emotional and deeply personal. Types of acquisitions. For the purpose of this discussion, it is useful to think about technology acquisitions in three categories. 1. Talent and or technology. When a company is acquired purely for its technology and or its people. These kinds of deals typically range between $5 million and $50 million. 2. Product. When a company is acquired for its product, but not its business. The acquirer plans to sell the product roughly as it is, but will do so primarily with its own sales and marketing capability. These kinds of deals typically range between $25 million and $250 million. 3. Business. When a company is acquired for its actual business, revenue, and earnings, the acquirer values the entire operation, product, sales, and marketing, not just the people, technology, or products. These deals are typically valued, at least in part, by their financial metrics, and can be extremely large, such as Microsoft's $30 billion plus offer for Yahoo. My take on the subject is most applicable to business acquisitions, with some relevance to product acquisitions, and will be fairly useless if you're selling people and or technology. The logical. When analyzing whether you should sell your company, a good basic rule of thumb is A, if you are very early on in a very large market, and B, you have a good chance of being number one in that market, then you should remain standalone. The reason is that nobody will be able to afford to pay you what you are worth, because nobody can give you that much forward credit. For an easy-to-understand example, consider Google. When they were very early, they reportedly received multiple acquisition offers for more than $1 billion. These were considered very rich offers at the time, and they amounted to a gigantic multiple. However, given the size of the ultimate market, it did not make sense for Google to sell. In fact, it didn't make sense for Google to sell to any suitor at any price that the buyer could have paid. Why? Because the market that Google was pursuing was actually bigger than the markets that all of the potential buyers owned, and Google had built a nearly invincible product lead that enabled them to be number one. Contrast this situation with Pointcast. Pointcast was one of the first internet applications to catch fire. They were the buzz of Silicon Valley and the technology industry in general. They received billion-dollar acquisition offers that they passed on. Then, due to flaws in their product architecture, their customers started to turn off their application. Overnight, their market collapsed and never returned. They were ultimately sold for a relatively tiny amount. So the judgment that you have to make is, A, is this market really much bigger, more than an order of magnitude, than has been exploited to date? And B, are we going to be number one? If the answer to either A or B is no, then you should consider selling. If the answers to both are yes, then selling would mean selling yourself and your employees short. Unfortunately, these questions are not as simple to answer as I made them out to be. In order to get the answer right, you also have to answer the question, what is the market really? And who are the competitors going to be? Was Google in the search market or the portal market? In retrospect, they were in the search market, but most people thought they were in the portal market at the time. Yahoo was a tough competitor in the portal market, but not so much in the search market. If Google had really been in the portal market, then selling might have been a good idea. Pointcast thought that their market was much larger than it turned out to be. Interestingly, Pointcast's own product execution, or lack thereof, caused their market to shrink. Let's look at the case of Opsware. Why did I sell Opsware? Another good question is why didn't I sell Opsware until I did? At Opsware, we started in the server automation market. When we received our first inquiries and offers for the server automation company, we had fewer than 50 customers. I believed that there were at least 10,000 target customers, and that we had a decent shot at being number one. In addition, although I knew the market would be redefined, I thought that we could expand to networks and storage, data center automation, faster than the competition and win that market as well. Therefore, assuming 30% market share, somebody would have had to pay 60 times what we were worth in forward credit to buy out our potential. You won't be surprised to find that nobody was willing to pay that. Once we grew to several hundred customers and expanded into data center automation, we were still number one and were more valuable standalone than any of the prior acquisition offers. At that point, both Opsware and our main competitor, BladeLogic, had developed into full-fledged companies, worldwide sales forces, built out professional services, etc. This was significant because it meant that a large company could buy one of us and potentially execute successfully. Big enterprise companies can't generally succeed with small acquisitions because too much of the important intellectual property is the sales methodology, and big companies can't build that. At this point, it became clear that BMC was going to buy either Opsware or BladeLogic. As a result, the calculus, or whether Opsware was going to be number one in the market, needed to be redefined as follows. 1. We had to be number one in the systems and network management market rather than the data center automation market, because like the word processor market, the data center automation market was going to be subsumed by a larger market that contained it. 2. In order to be number one, we had to beat BMC and BladeLogic together, which was a significantly more difficult opponent than either company standalone. Finally, the market itself was transforming due to an underlying technological shift, virtualization. Virtualization meant that the entire market needed to be retooled. So we were embarking on a new R&D race to build the best management for virtualized environments. This meant deferring earnings for a very long time. Based on all these factors, it made sense for us to at least consider the possibility of acquisition and run a short process to understand the interest in the M&A market. Through that process, 11 companies made acquisition offers of some form. This told me that we were at a local maxima in terms of the market price for Opsware. In other words, the set of potential buyers was convinced that the market was very important, and there was no extra premium that we could hope to achieve through better awareness. In the end, based on a lot of analysis and soul searching, I determined that the current local maxima was higher than we could expect to achieve in the next 3 to 5 years, and I sold the company to Hewlett-Packard for $1.65 billion. I think, and hope, that was the right decision. The emotional. The funny thing about the emotional part of the decision is that it's so schizophrenic. How can you ever sell your company after you've personally recruited every employee and sold them on your spectacular vision of a thriving standalone business? How can you ever sell out your dream? How can you walk away from total financial independence for yourself and every member of your close and distant family? Aren't you in business to make money? How much money does one person need? How can you reconcile Dr. Stay the Course and Mr. Sell the Thing? Clearly, they're irreconcilable, but the key is to mute them both. A few keys on muting the emotions. Get paid. A salary. Most venture capitalists like entrepreneurs that are all in, meaning the entrepreneur has everything invested in the company and will have very little to show for her efforts if it does not succeed. As part of this, they prefer the founding CEO to have a very low salary. In general, this is a good idea, because the temptation to walk away when things go poorly is intense, and total financial commitment helps him to keep his other commitments. However, once the company starts to become a company rather than an idea, it makes sense to pay the CEO at market. More specifically, once the company has a business as previously defined and becomes an attractive acquisition target, it makes sense to pay the CEO, so that the decision to keep or sell the company isn't a direct response to the CEO's personal financial situation. As in, I don't think that we should sell the company, but I live in an 850-square-foot apartment with my husband and 2 kids, and it's that or divorce. Be clear with the company. One question that every startup CEO gets from our employees is, are you selling the company? This is an incredibly difficult question. If she says nothing, the employee will likely interpret this to mean the company is for sale. If she says at the right price, the employee will wonder what that price is and may even ask. If the company ever reaches that price, the employee will assume the company will be sold. If she dodges the question with the standard, the company is not for sale, the employee may feel betrayed if the company is ever sold. More important, the CEO may feel like she is betraying the employee, and that feeling will influence her decision-making process. One way to avoid these traps is to describe the analysis in the prior section. If the company achieves product-market fit in a very large market and has an excellent chance to be number one, then the company will likely remain independent. If not, it will likely be sold. This is one good method to describe the interests of the investors in a way that's not at odds with the interests of the employees. And it is true. Final thought. When faced with the decision of whether to sell your company, there is no easy answer. However, preparing yourself intellectually and emotionally will help. Chapter 9. The End of the Beginning. We walk the same path, but got on different shoes. Live in the same building, but we got different views. Drake. Right above it. After selling Opsware, I spent a year at HP running the bulk of their software business. And then I tried to figure out what to do next. Should I start another company? Should I be CEO of someone else's company? Should I retire? Should I do something completely different? The more I thought about my future, the more I thought about my past. What would have happened if I'd never met Bill Campbell? How would I have possibly worked my way through all the challenges I'd faced? Why was entrepreneurship such a black art? Did everybody have the same problems I'd had? If they did, why didn't anybody write anything down? Why did so few startup advisors and venture capitalists have any experience starting companies? As these thoughts rolled around in my head, I sent Mark Andreessen an instant message. We ought to start a venture capital firm. Our model for general partners would be some experience required, as in some experience in founding and running companies is required to advise people who are founding and running companies. To my surprise, he replied, "I was thinking the same thing." Some experience necessary. Further contemplation took me back to one of my first serious encounters with venture capital. Back in 1999, after raising our first round of funding for LoudCloud, my co-founders and I went to visit our new venture capital firm and meet their full team. As founding CEO, I remember being excited to meet our financial backers and to talk about how we could partner to build a great company. The conversation took a sharp downhill turn when one of the senior partners, David Byrne, asked me in front of my co-founders, "When are you going to get a real CEO?" The comment knocked the wind out of me. Our largest investor had basically called me a fake CEO in front of my team. I asked, "What do you mean?" Hoping he would revise his statement and enable me to save face. Instead, he pressed on. "Someone who has designed a large organization, someone who knows great senior executives and brings pre-built customer relationships, someone who knows what they are doing." I could hardly breathe. It was bad enough that he had undermined my standing as CEO, but to make matters worse, I knew that at some level, he was right. I didn't have those skills. I had never done those things, and I did not know those people. I was the founding CEO, not a professional CEO. I could almost hear the clock ticking in the background as my time running the company quickly ran out. Could I learn the job and build my network fast enough, or would I lose the company? That question tortured me for months. In the years that followed, I remained CEO, for better or worse. I worked incredibly hard to become the kind of CEO that everyone expected. Thanks to a lot of effort and help from friends and mentors, especially Bill Campbell, the company survived and became successful and valuable. Not a day went by, however, when I didn't think about that interaction with David Byrne. I always wondered how long I had to grow up and how I could find help to build my skills and make the necessary connections along the way. Mark and I discussed this paradox often. We wondered aloud why, as founders, we had to prove to our investors beyond a shadow of a doubt that we could run the company, rather than our investors assuming that we would run the company we'd created. This conversation ultimately became the inspiration for Andreessen Horowitz. To get started, we studied the venture capital industry, and we came across a potential problem with our approach. Historically, all the returns in venture capital have been concentrated in a tiny number of firms, and consistently by a small number of the same firms. Of the more than 800 venture capital firms of the day, only about 6 had delivered great returns for their investors. As we dug deeper, we uncovered an excellent reason for this. The best entrepreneurs will only work with the best venture capital firms. Since venture capital firms were notoriously secretive about their methods and beliefs, most firms did almost no PR and stated very little about what they did. The firms competed on their investing track records. Therefore, the firms with the best track records continued to have the best track records, thus making it nearly impossible for a new firm with no track record to crack into the top tier. We needed some way to break through to become the firm that great entrepreneurs wanted to work with. But how? We needed to change the rules by which entrepreneurs evaluated VCs. We thought there was an opening to do this, because times had changed. When Mark and I first became entrepreneurs, back in the mid-1990s, we did not know many other entrepreneurs. We just did what we did, without really seeing ourselves as part of a larger movement or a community. We were entrepreneurs at the beginning of the internet, and before Facebook, Twitter, and the other social networking platforms were built, we did not talk to other entrepreneurs because there was no entrepreneurial community. We were completely heads down on the business. All that has changed in the last 10 years. Entrepreneurs are now socializing, friending each other, meeting up and hanging out. There's a real community. Once we realized this, we figured that if we had a better offering, word-of-mouth marketing would work now, where it hadn't before. We needed to be better, but we also needed to be different. As we thought about what would make us both better and different, two core ideas greatly influenced our thinking. First, Technical founders are the best people to run technology companies. All of the long-lasting technology companies that we admired, Hewlett-Packard, Intel, Amazon, Apple, Google, Facebook, had been run by their founders. More specifically, the innovator was running the company. Second, it was incredibly difficult for technical founders to learn to become CEOs while building their companies. I was a testament to that. But most venture capital firms were better designed to replace the founder than to help the founder grow and succeed. Mark and I thought that if we created a firm specifically designed to help technical founders run their own companies, we could develop a reputation and a brand that might vault us into the top tier of venture capital firms despite having no track record. We identified two key deficits that a founder CEO had when compared with a professional CEO. One, the CEO skill set, managing executives, organizational design, running sales organizations and the like were all important skills that technical founders lacked. Two, the CEO network. Professional CEOs knew lots of executives, potential customers and partners, people in the press, investors, and other important business connections. Technical founders, on the other hand, knew some good engineers and how to program. Next, we asked, how might a venture capital firm help founder CEOs close those gaps? Addressing the skill set issue proved to be difficult because, sadly, the only way to learn how to be a CEO is to be a CEO. Sure, we might try to teach some skills, but learning to be a CEO through classroom training would be like learning to be an NFL quarterback through classroom training. Even if Peyton Manning and Tom Brady were your instructors, in the absence of hands-on experience, you'd get killed the moment you took the field. We decided that while we would not be able to give a founder CEO all the skills she needed, we would be able to provide the kind of mentorship that would accelerate the learning process. As a result, we decided that all of our general partners would need to be effective mentors for a founder striving to be a CEO. Of course, not all founders want to be CEO. For some companies, the right thing is to bring in a professional CEO. For those companies, we would focus on helping the founders identify the right CEO and then helping the CEO successfully integrate into the company and partner with the founders to retain their unique strengths. This is why so many of the general partners we choose are former founders or CEOs or both, and they are all highly focused on helping founders become outstanding CEOs. The idea seemed so simple and obvious that it had to work. Next, we decided to systematize and professionalize the network. For this, we drew both the inspiration and the formula from my friend and Opsware board member, Michael Ovitz. 34 years earlier, Michael had founded Creative Artists Agency, CAA, the powerhouse of Hollywood talent agencies. When Michael started CAA, it was not an obvious idea. The talent agency business had existed since vaudeville and had changed very little in the ensuing 75 years. Michael was a rising star at the William Morris Agency, the most important agency in the industry at the time. Quitting that job to pursue what must have looked like a windmill tilt made no sense to anybody. But Michael had a clear vision. If he could build a firm so good that it attracted all the top talent in the world, then he would shift the economics of the industry from the corporations to the talent, where he felt that it belonged. The firms of the day were essentially collections of loosely affiliated talent agents. Agents worked under the same umbrella, but acted largely alone, each agent tapping into her own network on behalf of her own clients. For example, Agent A might introduce Dustin Hoffman to the head of Warner Brothers, but both the relationship with Dustin Hoffman and the relationship with Warner Brothers were controlled entirely by the agent. Other William Morris agents and clients didn't automatically get access to either. This traditional model sounded a lot like the traditional venture capital business, where VCs worked in the same firm but managed their own networks and their own portfolios. Ovid's breakthrough idea was to build an integrated network that would allow any of the firm's agents to connect their clients to a firm-wide grid of new opportunities. As a result, the firm would be 100 times more powerful than any one agent at any other agency. To implement the idea, Ovitz and his founding partners agreed to defer their salaries for several years and invest their commissions into building what Ovitz referred to as the franchise. The franchise consisted of specialists running networks and portfolios in each relevant area. Book publishing, international, music, and more. His theory worked, and within 15 years, CAA represented 90% of the top talent in Hollywood and had rewritten the rules, giving talent more say in deals and a bigger piece of the financial pie. We decided to copy CAA's operating model nearly exactly. In fact, Andreessen Horowitz employees had the same titles as the original CAA employees. Partner. Michael thought it was a great idea, but he was the only one. Everyone else offered some variation of the following. This is Silicon Valley, not Hollywood. You guys don't understand the business. Still, with Michael's endorsement and enthusiastic support, we pushed forward with the idea. As we applied it to venture capital, we decided to build the following networks. Large companies. Every new company needs to either sell something to or partner with a larger company. Executives. If you succeed, at some point, you need to hire executives. Engineers. In the technology business, you can never know enough great engineers. Press and analysts. We have a saying around the firm. Show it, sell it, hide it, keep it. Investors and acquirers. Being venture capitalists, providing access to money was obvious. Once we designed the firm, we needed to help entrepreneurs understand how we were different. This seemed tricky because no major venture capital firm did any marketing of any kind. We figured there must be a good explanation for this, but struggled to find one. Finally, Mark discovered that the original venture capital firms in the late 1940s and early 50s were modeled after the original investment banks such as J.P. Morgan and Rothschild. Those banks also did not do PR for a very specific reason. The banks funded wars, and sometimes both sides of the same war, so publicity was not a good idea. This insight, combined with our general instinct to counter-program whatever the big guys were doing, led us to launch Andreessen Horowitz with great fanfare. When deciding on the name, the biggest problem we faced was that, as a firm, we were nobodies. No track record, no portfolio companies, no nothing. But people knew us, and they especially knew Mark. So I said, rather than trying to create a totally new brand from scratch, why not just use your brand? Mark thought that made sense. But nobody would ever be able to spell Andreessen Horowitz when typing in the URL. Thinking back to old-time computer programming, in the days before programming languages supported internationalization, we used to have to internationalize our code. We called this internationalization process I-18N for short. Localization was L-10N, which meant I followed by 18 letters, followed by N. We decided that the firm's nickname would be A16Z, as in A, followed by 16 letters, followed by Z. We hired the Outcast Marketing Agency, headed up by its formidable founder, Margit Winmakers, to generate media interest. We needed people to know what we were about, as we had decided to defy the conventional venture capital theory of no PR. The daughter of a German pig farmer, Margit was the furthest thing from a swine wrangler imaginable. Smart and sophisticated, she was the Babe Ruth of PR. She worked her contacts, landing a cover story in Fortune in 2009 that featured Mark posing as Uncle Sam. Andreessen Horowitz was an overnight sensation, and yet Mark and I were still the only two people in the firm. After 8 years of running Loud Cloud and Opsware, I had learned so many hard lessons that building a team was easy. I understood the importance of hiring for strength rather than for lack of weakness, and I understood the meaning of fit. There are lots of smart people in the world, but smart is not good enough. I needed people who were great where I needed greatness. I needed people who really wanted to do the jobs they were hired for, and I needed people who believed in the mission to make Silicon Valley a better place to build a company. The first person we hired was Scott Cooper, who had been the director of finance from Opsware. Scott worked for me for nearly the entire 8 years, and I'm not sure that he enjoyed any of it, but he performed phenomenally nonetheless. He ran customer support, planning, and technical field operations during those years, but none of the jobs were what he wanted to do. Scott loved three tasks: running things, strategy, and deals. If he could do those things, he'd almost never sleep. But at Opsware, he'd only gotten to do two of the three. Not getting to work on transactions was torture for Scott. He was like a caged animal, and I'd kept him in that cage for 8 long years. So when we designed the firm, the first thing that came to my mind was, I finally found the perfect job for Cooper. Scott became the firm's chief operating officer. We then filled out the rest of the team. We hired Mark Cranny, head of sales at Opsware, to run the large company network. Shannon Callahan, former head of recruiting and HR, to run the engineering network. Marjeet Windmakers, the Sultan of SWAT, to run the marketing network. Jeff Stump, the best executive recruiter we knew, to run the executive network. And Frank Chen, my former head of product management, to run a centralized research group. Our theory about what a venture capital firm should offer turned out to resonate with the best entrepreneurs in the world. In 4 very short years, we have gone from nothing to being one of the most respected venture capital firms in the world. Final lesson. I know you think my life is good because my diamond piece, but my life been good since I started finding peace. Nas, Locomotive. I often joke that I am considered to be a much better CEO now than I was when I was actually CEO. These days people sometimes refer to me as a management guru. But when I managed Opsware, most people referred to me as, well, less than that. As Felicia is fond of saying, they called you everything but a child of God. What happened? Did I change? Or did perception change? There is no question that I learned a great deal over the years, and I am pretty embarrassed about how I conducted myself in the early days. But by the end, I became pretty good at running the company. There's plenty of evidence supporting this view. I completely changed our business midstream, even while it was a publicly traded company, and still managed to grow its value from $29 million to $1.65 billion in 5 years. A large percentage of the employees from Opsware either work for me at Andreessen Horowitz or in one of our portfolio companies, so they must have liked something about working together. The acquisition by HP was the largest outcome in the sector, so we won our market. Still, during the years that I was good at running Opsware, from 2003 to 2007, you would be hard-pressed to find a single article or blog post or message board comment that said anything nice about me. During that time, the press declared the company dead, and shareholders called for my resignation. Now, I was not considered to be very good at all. In retrospect, people's perceptions changed because of the sale to HP and the things that I've since written. Once I stopped being CEO, I was granted a freedom that I did not have before. As a venture capitalist, I have had the freedom to say what I want and what I really think without worrying what everybody else thinks. As a CEO, there is no such luxury. As CEO, I had to worry about what everybody else thought. In particular, I could not show weakness in public. It would not have been fair to the employees, the executives, or the public company shareholders. Unrelenting confidence was necessary. When we started Andreessen Horowitz, I could let all that go. Sure, we still have employees, but we do not have public shareholders who live and die on every piece of press. More important, at Andreessen Horowitz, I am not really CEO. We invest in companies that have CEOs. The burden of unrelenting confidence lies with them. I can now share my weaknesses, my fears, and my shortcomings. I can say what I want without worrying about offending the wrong people in the power structure. And it's those fears and controversial opinions that hold the clues to dealing with hard things. Hard things are hard because there are no easy answers or recipes. They are hard because your emotions are at odds with your logic. They are hard because you don't know the answer and you cannot ask for help without showing weakness. When I first became a CEO, I genuinely thought that I was the only one struggling. Whenever I spoke to other CEOs, they all seemed like they had everything under control. Their businesses were always going fantastic, and their experience was inevitably amazing. I thought that maybe growing up in Berkeley with communist grandparents might not have been the best background for running a company. But as I watched my peers' fantastic, amazing businesses go bankrupt and sell for cheap, I realized that I was probably not the only one struggling. As I got further into it, I realized that embracing the unusual parts of my background would be the key to making it through. It would be those things that would give me unique perspectives and approaches to the business. The things that I would bring to the table that nobody else had. It was my borrowing Chico Mendoza's shocking yet poetic style to motivate and focus the team. It was my understanding of the people underneath the persona and skin color that enabled me to put Jason Rosenthal together with Anthony Wright to save the company. It was even my bringing into the most capitalistic pursuit imaginable what Karl Marx got right. On my grandfather's tombstone, you will find his favorite Marx quote, "Life is struggle." I believe that within that quote lies the most important lesson in entrepreneurship. Embrace the struggle. When I work with entrepreneurs today, this is the main thing that I try to convey. Embrace your weirdness, your background, your instinct. If the keys are not in there, they do not exist. I can relate to what they're going through, but I cannot tell them what to do. I can only help them find it in themselves. And sometimes they can find peace where I could not. Of course, even with all the advice and hindsight in the world, hard things will continue to be hard things. So in closing, I just say peace to all those engaged in the struggle to fulfill their dreams. This is Kevin Kennerly. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Hard Thing About Hard Things, Building a Business When There Are No Easy Answers, by Ben Horowitz. This program was produced by Elgin Productions. The director was John McElroy. Executive producer, Karen Jakonski. Text copyright 2014 by Ben Horowitz. Production copyright 2014 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.